Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 61. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. If you love Talking Tudors, if you never miss an episode and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. January's prize is a copy of The Falcon's Rise, a novel of Anne Boleyn by Natalia Richards. A huge thank you to the author for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Nicola Tallis to Talking Tudors to discuss Margaret Beaufort. Dr. Tallis has a first-class BA honours in history from Bath Spa University and an MA in public history from Royal Holloway College, University of London. She acquired her doctorate from the University of Winchester, where her thesis investigated the jewellery collections of the Queens of England between 1445 and 1548. Nicola has worked as a historical researcher and a curator, and currently lectures at the University of Winchester. Nicola's debut book, Crown of Blood, The Deadly Inheritance of Lady Jane Grey, was published in November 2016, and is the result of 5 years of research on the Grey family. Elizabeth's Rival, The Tumultuous Tale of Lettice Knowles, Countess of Leicester, was published in 2017. An Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, Tudor Matriarch, was published in 2019. My conversation with Nicola straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, Nicola. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, Natalie.
Oh, it's so lovely to have you back. Now, since our last chat, which was actually in December 2018, I can't believe how fast time's flown, we've had, you know, a lot of new listeners find the podcast. So would you mind just introducing yourself and telling our listeners a little bit about your background?
Yeah, of course. So obviously, I'm Nicola Tallis, and I am the author of Crown of Blood, Elizabeth's Rival, and most recently, Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, Tudor Matriarch. And I'm a historian and a researcher by background. So I recently, well, I say recently, a year ago, actually, I completed my PhD, which was concentrated on the jewellery collections of the Yorkist and early Tudor queens. So that is my specialist field.
That sounds like a wonderful field to specialise in, I must say.
Yeah, it's great fun.
Now, the last time we spoke, we actually chatted about Lady Jane Grey. And for anyone that's listening that might want to tune into that episode, that was actually episode 16. So you can have a look at that and listen to that one as well. But today we're actually going to talk about an equally fascinating character. And as you mentioned, the subject of your latest biography, which is Margaret Beaufort. So, Nicola, she's someone whose story you've always been interested in.
She's someone who's always been on my radar, but perhaps more in the background, because she did form a very small part of my PhD research, because although she wasn't a queen, I think she probably would have quite liked to have been a queen, but she formed a very useful point of comparison. So she's always been on my radar, but perhaps not always directly until I began writing my book about her.
Okay, and what can you tell us about Margaret's upbringing and her family?
Well, we don't know a great deal about her upbringing, frustratingly, but we do know that she was brought up in a relatively happy family environment, raised primarily by her mother, Margaret Beauchamp. It was quite tragic. She lost her father when she was just a few days short of her first birthday, possibly in very tragic circumstances, because it was rumoured that the Duke of Somerset, Margaret's father, had committed suicide, which was as a result of a dismal French military campaign that had ended in his disgrace. But Margaret would have had no memory of that or of her father. As I say, she was raised primarily by her mother in the castles of Bledsoe and Maxey in Northamptonshire and Bedfordshire. And she was raised with her half-siblings, the St. Johns, who were children who'd been produced as a result of her mother's first marriage. And there's evidence to suggest that there was a very warm and close bond between all of these children. Certainly later in life, there are references to the St. Johns littered throughout Margaret's accounts. And, you know, she did a great deal to support these half-siblings. So I would suggest that family and family loyalty was something that mattered very much to her and was very strongly linked with her upbringing. So, yeah, she was, to all intents and purposes, raised in quite a happy family environment.
Okay, and how did her marriage to Edmund Tudor come about?
So that came about in 1453. As a result of what had happened was Margaret had been betrothed and then married to the heir of the Duke of Suffolk. And the Duke of Suffolk had been murdered in 1450. And Margaret did remain married to his son, although she was very, very, very young at this time. And it was a marriage of words only. But it was dissolved in 1453 when she was 9 years old, because at this time, Margaret's kinsman, Henry VI, had decided on a better match for her, and that match was with his half-brother Edmund Tudor. And although Margaret became Edmund's ward in 1453 when she was nine, the marriage didn't take place immediately, and it actually took place very soon after Margaret's 12th birthday in 1455.
Okay, so she was obviously very young when she gave birth to her son, the future Henry VII. So what impact do you think this had on her physically, but also emotionally?
I mean, there's no doubt that childbirth took its toll on her and scarred her, certainly emotionally and possibly physically. In terms of physically, it's often been sort of said rather dismissively that, you know, that the damage caused to Margaret's body as a result of childbirth rendered her physically unable of producing another child. And certainly we know she didn't produce any further children, and we certainly don't think that she experienced any further pregnancies either, although we don't know this for sure. But it's very difficult to assess physically 500 years later what damage, if any, this did to Margaret. It is possible that there were obviously physical implications, but certainly the psychological scars were more clear to see. And we see this later when Margaret urged her son not to allow her granddaughter and namesake to hurry to Scotland for her marriage to James IV too early, in case, in James's haste to consummate the union, he might injure her and endanger her health. And it's very obvious that Margaret was speaking from her own personal experience here. And, you know, there is also evidence to suggest that she loathed sex. And who can blame her? It's very clear that in psychological terms, although she utterly adored her son and he was without doubt the most important person in her life, the effects of giving birth at such an early age did traumatize her.
So it is possible that her not having children was a choice. There's nothing really to suggest, well, not to suggest, but there's no strong evidence to prove that she couldn't have children. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And that is actually one of my theories, is that I think that she may well have made a conscious decision not to become pregnant again. And, you know, and there, again, we will never know for certain, but there are hints that this is possibly the case. And we know that when she took her third husband, Henry Stafford, that he was an older man again. And, you know, he was also in ill health at certain times throughout his life. And I can't help but wonder if perhaps this, again, was something that Margaret was aware of before she married him, and that this kind of helps to enforce her decision that choosing him, it might mean that she wouldn't have to have any more children.
Now, Margaret's life played out obviously against the backdrop of what we now call the Wars of the Roses, the dynastic struggles between the houses of Lancaster and York. So where did Margaret's allegiances lie?
Her allegiances lay very firmly with the House of Lancaster. So as I mentioned, Henry VI was her kinsman and her family were wholeheartedly loyal to him. And, you know, Margaret would retain this loyalty to Henry for the rest of her life. But she understood the need to be pragmatic and to bend the knee, if you like, to another royal house when she had to. And she, as soon as her son was born, there wasn't just Margaret to consider anymore. She had Henry's interests also and his future. And that came above all else. And for this reason, Margaret was fully prepared to ingratiate herself with Edward IV, the Yorkists. And we see her doing this continually, but more prominently, I suppose, during the latter part of Edward IV's reign. It was very difficult for her, though, because her husband, Henry Stafford, had fought for Henry VI at the Battle of Towton. And fortunately for Stafford, he was pardoned by Edward IV. And from that point onwards, he seems to change his allegiance from Lancaster to York. And although Margaret, you know, was politically astute enough to recognise that Edward IV was now the king and was a stronger king, I think this still must have been quite difficult for her to swallow, given her own, you know, very strong ties and roots to her family.
Absolutely. And I imagine she would have always kind of been on their radar as someone who could possibly cause some issues.
Yeah. And that is evident, particularly when Edward IV first came to the throne, that he didn't trust her at all. And, you know, so Margaret did have to work doubly hard later on to try and gain his trust.
So considering that there must have been obviously a little bit of tension there in that relationship, what role did she actually play at the Yorkist court during Henry's exile?
Well, it all came about when her husband Henry Stafford died in October 1471, possibly as a result of battle injuries that he'd sustained at the Battle of Barnet, where he'd fought for Edward IV. And Margaret didn't waste any time in arranging a fourth marriage. So in June 1472, by which time Henry Stafford had been dead for less than a year, she married Thomas Stanley, who was a member of Edward IV's household. And one of the primary motivations for this was the fact that Stanley was a member of Edward's household, because this also gave Margaret an opportunity to have direct contact with Edward, which was something that she'd never really previously had, because, you know, Edward IV hadn't particularly favoured her previous husband, Henry Stafford, at all. So with her marriage to Stanley, we begin to see Margaret playing a more active role in court ceremonial. We don't know exactly how often she was at Edward's court, but we do know that she was afforded a role in the reburial of Edward's father and brother, the Duke of York and the Earl of Rutland, in 1476. And we know also that she was given the honour of carrying Princess Bridget, the king's youngest daughter, to her christening at Eltham in 1480. And of course, this would have been considered a singular honour. And this is all suggestive of Edward's growing trust for Margaret, and the fact that she was obviously doing a good job to convince him of her loyalties.
Now, talk to us about the plot that Margaret was involved in to overthrow Richard III.
Yeah, so that obviously came about in 1483, when Edward IV died unexpectedly. And of course, within a matter of weeks, Edward's two sons, the Princes in the Tower, as they're of course popularly remembered, were placed in the Tower of London, and Richard III declared himself king, or was declared king, in June. And it's not quite clear exactly what turned or what changed Margaret's mindset as such, because it's very clear that during the reign of Edward IV, she had been working to effect a reconciliation between the king and her son, Henry Tudor, and she had come very, very close. Whether she sensed a change in Richard's attitude towards Henry that was, you know, different from the conciliatory approach adopted by Edward IV, we don't quite know. But whatever the reason, Margaret's thoughts soon turned to plotting against Richard. And her plan was for Henry Tudor to marry Elizabeth of York, who many people considered to be the true heir to the throne following the disappearance of the Princes in the Tower. She was, of course, the eldest of Edward IV's daughters. And for Henry then to wear the crown once worn by his Lancastrian forebears and become King of England. And it was in this vein that she began plotting against Richard and enlisted the support of the Duke of Buckingham, who had been Richard's very close ally, but for some reason had become disaffected from Richard. And, you know, there's a lot of debate over whether she sort of coerced Buckingham into plotting with her on false pretenses, you know, by double bluffing, and basically sort of, because Buckingham had a claim to become king as well. And you know, whether saying that, you know, she would support him or not. But anyway, the plan was for Henry to become king. Unfortunately, it was a dismal failure, and Buckingham was captured and executed. And Henry Tudor, who at this time was in Brittany, had sailed from Brittany to England to support the plan, but having heard that the plot had failed, was forced to turn around and return. But for Margaret, there was nowhere for her to go, and having committed high treason, she was now forced to wait and see how Richard would treat her. And fortunately for her, she was spared the death penalty, but only by reason of the fact that her husband was a key supporter to, or, you know, considered by Richard III to be a key supporter and a valuable ally. And Richard couldn't afford to risk alienating Lord Stanley by ordering the execution of his wife. And so it's for that reason that Margaret was spared the death penalty.
And Nicola, so I was just thinking, so up until, you mentioned that obviously Edward IV died quite unexpectedly and he was still a fairly young man. So up until that point, is there any evidence to suggest that Margaret's plan was to put Henry on the throne, even at, like, in those early stages when Edward was still alive and still healthy and, you know, thought to continue his reign?
No, absolutely not. Right. It's very, very clear that she was just working at this time to try and work out a way that she could bring her son home from foreign exile. And Yeah, at this time, we have to remember, as you said, Edward IV died quite a young age, and it was unexpected. And Margaret had no reason to hope that there was any chance that Henry might become king, because to all intents and purposes, Edward's line seemed fairly secure, because he was this, you know, he was in relatively good health, and he also had two sons to succeed him. And you know, Margaret obviously knew this. And yeah, it's very clear she was trying to bring about a pardon for her son. And she did come very, very close. So close, in fact, that Edward IV did draft a pardon for Henry Tudor. But unfortunately, he died before it could be put into effect.
Thank you for clarifying, because I think that's one of those things that confuses people because of how it's been depicted in, you know, shows and series and books and that sort of thing. So what was Margaret's relationship with Elizabeth Woodville like, and how did these women work together to place their children on the throne? You've touched on this a little bit, but can you go into that a little bit more?
Yeah, again, it's one of those that's frustratingly vague, because we don't know a great deal about their relationship. I suspect that Margaret would have been as shocked as the rest of the realm when she heard that Edward IV had married Elizabeth, because she was a woman who was, you know, very acutely conscious of her own roots and her own family heritage. And so I think that the fact that Edward IV had married, you know, this commoner would have come as a surprise to her. But whether or not, you know, she still clearly served at Elizabeth's court and showed her all due deference. But and then when the Buckingham Rebellion came about, Margaret was clearly willing to plot with Elizabeth on her son's behalf. And she used her position as a go-between the two women. But when, of course, the Buckingham Rebellion failed, shortly afterwards, Elizabeth Woodville's eldest son, the Marquis of Dorset, he fled to join Henry Tudor in exile. And later, when Elizabeth Woodville came to, I suppose we could say she did kind of reconcile with Richard III, and she urged her son Dorset to abandon Henry Tudor and come home. And I don't think that Margaret would have forgotten about this. Her confessor, Bishop Fisher, says that, you know, she had an excellent memory. And I'm sure that, you know, Margaret would not have forgotten that Elizabeth had reconciled with their enemy, Richard III. And yeah, and this would have been sort of considered a great insult by her. And, you know, of course, in 1487, 2 years after Henry Tudor became king, Elizabeth Woodville, of course, was sent off to Bermondsey. And I can't help but wonder if Margaret may have played some hand in that as well. And, you know, may have well felt that it was too crowded at court with Elizabeth of York herself and Elizabeth Woodville there. But that's just me speculating. But I would certainly say that there's no evidence of any great warmth between the two women, but nor is there any evidence of any great discord between them either.
Okay, and so once Henry comes to the throne, just how much influence does Margaret wield over the newly crowned king? And did they actually share a very close bond? Was it a good relationship?
Yeah, I mean, they were inseparable, basically. And in the early weeks of Henry's reign, he actually went to Woking Palace, which was Margaret's favourite home, and spent some time with her there. And it's very clear that he sort of craved his mother's company, and that there was a very close and warm bond between them, in spite of the fact that they hadn't actually spent very much time together during Henry's youth by reason of the political circumstances. In terms of how much influence she wielded, again, it's very difficult to pinpoint this precisely in political terms. Certainly, there is a source later on, the Spanish ambassador, who claimed that basically Margaret was the most important woman in the realm and wielded huge influence over the king. And there's certainly no doubt that he trusted her implicitly and was very aware and very conscious of her abilities and her capabilities. And we can see this later when he entrusted her with the role of basically administering justice on his behalf in the Midlands which she did from her palace of Collie Weston. And this, again, this was a really unprecedented role for a woman at this time, and is an indication of Henry's trust in his mother. But certainly for the early part of his reign, mother and son were almost inseparable, and Margaret was a constant presence at Henry's court. There were apartments set aside in each of the royal palaces for her use, and they were always close to those of Henry. And sometimes the mother and son even had an interjoining chamber so that they could, you know, access one another very easily. So yeah, it's all very suggestive of a very, very warm and affectionate relationship between the two.
It's interesting, isn't it, considering the time that they spent apart in those really formative years as well for Henry. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's, again, Henry had seen how much Margaret had risked on his behalf, as in she had, of course, she could have been executed by Richard III in the aftermath of the Buckingham Rebellion. And even that hadn't quelled her support for her son. So I think Henry had seen how much she had put at stake on his behalf and risks for his sake, and he couldn't have failed to obviously be very grateful for this, but obviously knew how much he meant to his mother.
Nicola, was she the mother-in-law from hell? She's often depicted like that in books and movies. Yeah. Is that what we're sensing? Or
I don't think she was, actually. I think that that's an unfair portrayal, because I think the fact that she was constantly at court, we have to remember that, as we've said, she hadn't spent much time with Henry. She'd missed out on most of his youth. And so her desire to be close to him is, I think, completely understandable. And evidently, Henry wanted her there as well. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. But no, I think that there's a great deal of evidence that the relationship that Margaret shared with Elizabeth of York was actually a very close one. And we see them working in harmony together on many occasions throughout Henry's reign. And I think undoubtedly Margaret may have got on Elizabeth's nerves at times, because anybody living in such close proximity, or it's almost like this menage a trois. And I'm sure that that would have grated on Elizabeth from time to time. But she was reportedly of, you know, quite gentle nature. And I don't think that it would have bothered her unduly. There's only actually really one source which suggests that, which hints at some discord between Margaret and her daughter-in-law. And that comes from the Spanish ambassador in 1498. But actually, all other evidence suggests that they actually got along together rather well. And I think that predominantly this would have been the case, and that had there been any true cracks in their relationship, then we'd have heard more about it from contemporary reports.
So Margaret obviously brought with her a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of experience from her time at the Lancastrian court, the Yorkist courts. How did Margaret actually influence the development of royal etiquette and protocol at the Tudor court?
So there is, and I am going to say that it's a bit of a myth. There's been this long-standing belief that she was responsible for the creation of the household ordinances that were, that were brought in. But there is actually no evidence that Margaret was responsible for these. And I think that certainly she would have shown an interest in the development of the court protocol. We know that she was very interested in etiquette and making sure that things were done just so and properly. And we know, again, that she did later create some ordinances for royal mourning. But as for the household ordinances themselves, as I say, there's no evidence that she was actually linked with those. And I think certainly she would have taken an interest in them. But as I say, we can't definitively credit her with their creation.
Thank you. I love a good bit of myth busting. I always wonder how these things get embedded in the kind of history without any evidence. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So what do you think in the end, Nicola, fueled that sheer determination and ambition that obviously her son greatly admired, as you've already said, and eventually she had that determination to found a dynasty. So was it her religious side? Was it a bit of vanity? What was it that fueled that, do you think?
Yeah, very interesting. I think basically she was a person who was never one to miss an opportunity. And I think really it was partly luck. You know, had it not been for the death of Edward IV in 1483, I don't think that Margaret would ever have espied an opportunity for her son in that way again. And I think, yes, certainly religion was a massive driving force in Margaret's life, although I have to add that I don't think it's quite fair for some of the portrayals that we've seen of her as this kind of religious fanatic who was driven by her belief that God had destined her son to become King of England. I don't think that there's any evidence that that's the true story at all. But I think certainly, yeah, perhaps vanity played a role in it as well. As I said before, she was very acutely conscious of who she was, and she was very proud of her heritage and her links. And, you know, she took great care throughout her life to proclaim her Beaufort heritage, which I find really interesting, given that many people, even following Henry Tudor's accession to the throne, many people considered both the Beauforts and the Tudors to be bastards and illegitimate stock. So it's very interesting, I think, that Margaret kind of went against the grain here and, you know, was very proud to emphasize these connections in her life and wasn't ashamed of them, I suppose. So I think, yeah, there's a combination of things. I think, yeah, there's luck to consider, yeah, probably a bit of vanity and a bit of pride as well. And yes, yeah, certainly religion was a very important part of Margaret's life too.
And as you've already said that in, you know, novels and on the screen, she's often portrayed as this kind of not devout but like a fanatic, a religious fanatic, and also quite negatively a little bit dry, not a very interesting character.
Yeah.
Tell us about a little bit about the woman who emerged from your research.
Well, she certainly wasn't dry.
That's good. Yeah, I didn't imagine she was.
But I have to admit, you know, that was something that I struggled with when I first came to approach this project, because I had this perception of her as being quite dry as well. And so I thought, you know, how am I gonna make this woman come to life? And as it happened, I didn't need to do anything because it was all there in front of me. And when we study Margaret's account books, and we're very fortunate that there's quite a complete set of them that survives from Henry the Seventh's time as king through to Margaret's death. And it's really, really very fascinating, because this picture emerges of a woman who, yes, she was pious, yes, she was devout, but she was also able to combine this with her ability to have a good time. And we see so many glimpses of this in her accounts. So we know that she had two fools, one who was named Skip and another who was rather sadly named Reginald the Idiot. And there are loads of payments for these fools throughout her accounts where, you know, she was paying for Skip's clothes. She would pay for them to be washed. She'd pay for his special high-heeled shoes. So we see payments for them. And we also see payments on one occasion for a man who was sent to deputise for her on a pilgrimage whilst she played cards. again, that's sort of a different side to her character, I guess. But she did absolutely love cards, and she loved chess. She was often known to place bets on the results of games of chess. She loved to be entertained by, for example, we see another payment to some Spaniards who danced the Morris, and for a child who sang a song for her. This is definitely a woman who liked to enjoy life, and she also really loved the finer things in life. So again, we see lots of payments for both red and white wine, and also for fashion. She's always portrayed in her portraits wearing black, which was a hugely expensive dye, so is an indication of her immense wealth. But actually, her wardrobe also contained dresses that were made of crimson, dresses that were made of purple. There were also payments for accessories like gloves, slippers, spectacles that were always made from gold, as were the cases. And also for Margaret's jewels, of which she was very, very fond. So we get this image of a woman who really enjoyed the fine things in life and who didn't always take herself too seriously. And I think that that's a really important point to take away from this, is that, in many aspects of Margaret's life were very, very serious, but she wasn't always like that, and she did have a sense of humour.
Well, isn't that wonderful? Completely different to the kind of portrayal that I'm sure a lot of people are used to when they think of Margaret Beaufort. I'm sure fun isn't the first word that comes into their mind. So that's really fabulous. Now, Nicola, are you currently working on any new Tudor books?
No, I have to say, for the first time in quite a while, I'm not yet. It won't be long, but I'm still considering my next project at the moment, and it's quite nice to have a bit of time to sort of think about it before delving straight in. So I can promise that there will be another Tudor book, but I don't know what it's going to be yet.
That's okay. We'll wait and see. We'll wait patiently and see what happens. Now, as you know, at the end of the episodes, I like to ask my guests 10 little questions just to get to know them a little bit better.
Yes.
So are you ready for number one?
Yes.
Okay. What was one of your favorite reads of 2019?
Oh, I have to say, I didn't read an awful lot in 2019, but I would say without doubt, it was Tracy Borman's The Devil's Slave, which was brilliant.
And what's something you're looking forward to this year?
Something I'm looking forward to this year. Well, I'm currently planning my wedding, so I'm quite looking forward to having some time to take out and enjoy doing that. That's for sure.
Well, that is very exciting. Now, do you have a signature recipe?
I do, actually, and it's for spaghetti carbonara.
Oh, yum. That sounds good. And what was the last film that you watched?
The last film that I watched was Paddington 2.
Oh, yes, that's cute, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just watched The Little Women, actually. So if you haven't seen that yet, I highly recommend it. Really beautiful.
That's good to know. It's on my bucket list.
When you've obviously spent the last few years sort of, I think, writing back to back, if memory serves me well. So describe a day in your life when you're writing. Like, do you have any rituals that you follow or any little things you do to prepare yourself for writing?
Yeah, I do, actually. I always make sure that I've got a lavender candle burning in my study, which just helps to relax me. And quite often I have classic FM playing in the background.
Wow. So you can write and listen to music. Those people are always amazed. I need to have everything quiet, like just silence.
No, I can be like that as well. But yeah, I have to have that. And I'll also always have either a peppermint or a green tea to my side.
And obviously you like the classical music. What other music do you enjoy listening to?
I absolutely love The Script. They're my favourite band.
Oh, I don't know them, I'm sorry to say.
They're fabulous. They're fabulous. Honestly, at the Hall of Fame, which is one of their signature songs, is the most inspiring song to me. And it's, just my all-time favourite.
All right. Well, you know what I'll be listening to straight after this? I'll be listening to Hall of Fame. So if money was no issue, name three locations that you'd visit on your dream holiday.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Thailand would be number one, I think. I would love to visit Australia, and I would also love to go to the Seychelles.
Yeah, that's a nice combination there. I think you're getting a lot of sun in that trip, Nicola.
Yeah.
Now, apart from obviously you have a great love of the Tudor period and 15th and 16th century England, are you drawn to any other period of history?
I'm always fascinated by the Victorian period also. I'm watching the third series of Victoria at the moment. And I also, one of the books that I really enjoyed in 2019 was Hallie Reubenhold's The Five. So that period really grabs me as well.
And what's, apart from your writing and researching and obviously your family, what's something that brings you joy, something maybe you enjoy doing?
I really love yoga and Pilates. That's my real go-to, because it always makes me feel good, and it always makes me feel very relaxed just having that time to go out and do my own thing for a bit.
Yeah, that's lovely. And lucky last, if you could spend 5 minutes with any person from Tudor history, who would you choose?
Oh, I think I would have to say Lady Jane Grey. Because she was obviously the subject of my very, very first book. And I would just love to have the opportunity to see what she was like, and to ask her some of those those questions that we all want to know. You know, was she abused as a child, and did she love Guildford Dudley, and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I imagine the subject of your first book will always hold a very special place in your heart, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so very last thing is our Tudor takeaway. So something, Nicola, for us to check out after this episode, our website, song, movie. Do you have a Tudor takeaway?
I certainly do. It's it's one that you'll have to wait for, I'm afraid.
That's all right.
But it's the Elizabeth and Mary exhibition at the British Library, which I believe is opening this October. And I was very fortunate to speak at the British Library in December. And so they were talking to me about all of the things that they had already curated in order for the exhibition, and you know, some of the aims of the exhibition. And I can promise that it sounds like it's going to be absolutely spectacular and dazzling. So yeah, please do check that one out.
That sounds fabulous. I'll add a link to that so we can all put that in our diaries if we're close by.
Yes.
All right, well, it's been such a pleasure chatting to you again, and I can't wait to hear about your future projects. And thanks so much for talking Tudors.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.